I was going to go on with New Left, particularly European New Left, which draws in Eastern Europe, which draws on this, but I'm waiting some materials in the mail. So I decided instead to go to two other topics this week which also follow out of this same area, namely Christian Marxist dialogue, and then Friday, Junger Moltmann's Theology of Hope, which has to a great extent been influenced by Christian Marxist dialogue. Now, what is Christian Marxist dialogue? We are all familiar, of course, with Christian Marxist non-dialogue, Christian Marxist antagonism. So perhaps we might start out by reviewing, in a sort of simple way, the sources of Christian Marxist antagonism. From the beginning, of course, Marxism announced itself as the foe of organized religion and society. It saw the existing Christian churches as the class religion of the bourgeois, and religion itself as the ideological expression of man's alienation. So socialism was sort of posed as the foe of religion, and it was believed that religion would wither away in the socialist state as the alienation of man itself was overcome. You see, as man's alienation, his economic alienation, was overcome, then these alienated ideological superstructures would also wither away. Now, in addition to this, Marxism in practice has developed, not in the heartland of capitalism, which is where Marx originally thought it would take place, but rather in Eastern countries, beginning in Russia, China, and so forth. And so in its actual historical practice, you've had a kind of conflict between European civilization, which has also been the heartland of Christian civilization, and Marxist countries, which now become sort of the new Eastern peril and so on, threatening what is seen as Western Christian civilization. Historical development, Marxist states have sort of appeared as the new barbarian threat and so forth from the point of Christianity. Now, this kind of double thing of Marxist original analysis of religion plus the fact that Marxist states have sort of developed in a kind of antagonism to Europe has also sort of set the stage for Christian antagonism to communism. Christian antagonism to communism, of course, rooted originally in its idea of Marxism, you know, as godless communism opposed to religion and so forth, but also developing into a whole new dimension by a kind of subtle identification of Christianity with Western civilization and capitalism, you see. So to be Christian is to be simultaneously the champion of capitalism and Western civilization over against, you see, this godless communism and so on. And this, of course, has set the stage for a great world contest between two superpowers, of which, if it continues, will very likely destroy the world. So therefore, some resolution, some dialogue is extremely important if the human race is to survive. That's the first good reason for Christian Marxist dialogue. Now, over against this Christian Marxist antagonism, however, has been a intellectual tradition, much less important politically, but nevertheless always there from the very beginning, of Christian Marxist affinity or Christian socialist affinity. And this is much less known because it hasn't had the same kind of political impact, but it has always been there at the same time. So let's for a minute discuss the earlier Christian socialist affinity. Almost from the very beginning, even back as early as the 1840s with people like Frederick Denison Maurice and the English Christian socialists, there have been groups of Christian churchmen who felt that socialism and Christianity were very closely allied, that socialism in many ways was taking up in a secular form the gospel, and that its whole message of criticism of alienation, criticism of competition, the competitive society, criticism of laissez-faire, that this was eminently Christian, and that socialist future hope, the hope for a new cooperative society, was indeed a secular form of the Christian future hope for the kingdom of God. So there you've had a tradition throughout the 19th century and on into the 20th century of Christian socialism, people who felt that Christian churchmen and so forth, who felt that socialist judgmentalism, socialist prophetism, and socialist future hope were very closely allied with Christianity, and were in fact a secularized form of the gospel. And this has been a continual tradition from the English Christian socialists to the American social gospel people and on like that. And you even had people like Reinhold Niebuhr, who felt that the apocalypticism of Marxism also had deep roots in the Christian tradition, was also a secularized version of the Christian understanding of the radical conflict between good and evil. So on the Christian side, you've had a less important politically, but nevertheless continuous tradition of Christian socialism. On the Marxist side, I think less well known, but nevertheless something which is becoming more evident now, there has been also a long tradition of identifying not with Christianity as a whole, but rather with a particular tradition within Christianity. If for those of you who were here Monday, you remember that Marx himself took a lot of his categories out of sort of left-wing Christian theologians. And then the disciples of Marx, particularly the great sort of Marxist theoreticians of the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, were quite interested in religion. And I have some of these books on the board. Engels himself wrote a great deal on religion. There's a book in which his writings on religion are gathered together. I think it's called Marx and Engels on Religion. You also get a figure like Ernst Bloch, a very interesting Marxist philosopher who's written great volumes called The Principle of Hope. And it's really a whole analysis of the concept of future hope in human culture. And a great deal of it is, of course, drawn from religious future hope. And he sees this as, flowing into the whole socialist future hope. So Bloch's great book on the principle of hope. He also wrote a book on Thomas Münzer as a theologian of revolution. Karl Klausky, another one of the chief Marxist theoreticians of the late 19th or 20th century, wrote a book on the foundations of Christianity. He also wrote a book on Thomas More, which is not up there. He wrote another book on communism in Central Europe at the time of the Reformation. Edward Bernstein, sort of the parallel to Klausky at the same period, wrote a book on the Puritan Revolution called Cromwell and Communism, Socialism and Democracy in the English Revolution. Now, if you look at these books, you can see the period in which these Marxists are interested. They are interested in primitive Christianity, and they are interested in left-wing Christianity of the Reformation and Puritan Revolution. In other words, the Anabaptists, the left-wing Puritans, and so on. The reason why they're interested in these particular periods is that they see these as the apocalyptic tradition of Christianity. In other words, they in repudiating what's seen as establishment Christianity, they nevertheless find an affinity with left-wing or apocalyptic Christianity and see this as the revolutionary tradition in Christianity, which is of which they themselves are the heir. In other words, they see themselves as coming down through the tradition of left-wing Christianity and identify with this as a part of their own heritage. So you get this kind of tradition in Marxism of scholarship on Christianity, particularly interested in what they see as the apocalyptic tradition in the early church and in the Reformation and 17th century. As a tradition with which Marxism itself can identify. Okay, so that's the sort of traditional antagonism and also the traditional affinity, the traditional basis for dialogue, so to speak. Now, about, let's say, 1956, with the denunciation of Stalinism by Khrushchev, which was kind of a, you know, crisis point for established communism. A new development began to take place, particularly in Eastern Europe. And as I mentioned Monday, there began a search for a Marxist humanism over against established Marxism of Stalinism and the communist parties. In other words, there was a kind of, what I call a kind of Marxist Protestantism, an attempt to go back to the sources, an attempt to create an independent critical Marxism over against the established church, so to speak, which is what the Marxist Party had become. It is this critical Marxism, this Marxism looking for a Christian humanism over against the established Marxism of the parties, that became the new basis for dialogue in the late 1950s and then going on into the 1960s. It became kind of the big new thing to engage in Christian Marxist dialogue among sort of Eastern European theologians, German theologians, and so on. You had some very big meetings. Not surprisingly, it was Karl's University in Prague, in Czechoslovakia, that became very much the center of these kind of meetings. And you have in Czechoslovakia Christian theologians like Romagda, who have much earlier in the decade before this development had been engaging in Christian Marxist dialogue from the Christian side and trying to show how Christianity could appreciate many elements of Marxism but at the same time pose its own critique of Marxism that would not be merely a reactionary and so on. So you had here in Czechoslovakia and in Poland and in Hungary and so on Christian theologians open to this kind of discussion, and then more and more you had a kind of new critical Marxist philosopher who was ready for this kind of dialogue and who, both from what he could learn from Christianity and in order to develop an independent position over against the party, and particularly, of course, the kind of domination that was coming out of Moscow. Okay, so that became sort of the new basis of dialogue in the 1960s. You've got some very important writings. The one I'll talk mostly about today is Garrodi's book, From Anathema to Dialogue, because that is available to you here. It's a very simple book that's easy to read, and it's in our library, both the that library in there and the other one in the Village Center. There are also other Marxists who have engaged in this, a figure like Kolakowski, who has, I think, just presently left Poland. A lot of these people are being driven out. He has left Poland to teach in Canada just this last year. Milan Machovec, I think he's a Hungarian, also has written a book called Marxism and Dialectical Theology. Most of these are in German. Been translated in German, but not into English. There was a big symposium called Disputation Between Christians and Marxists, in which Christians and Marxists each treated different subjects like future hope, this man, and so on. That was published in 1966. So on. So there's been a number of studies. You have Eric Fromm's big book where he called Marxist Humanism, in which he printed a lot of articles by these Marxists who are doing this kind of thinking. So there's been building up over the last 5 years or so a literature of Christian Marxist dialogue. On the Christian side, you have people like Junger Moltmann, who has been, he's a Protestant theologian who's been very involved in this, and to a large extent his own theology has come out of this Christian Marxist dialogue. You have Catholic theologians like Karl Rahner and Johann Metz and others. Of course, Harvey Cox has also been involved. So you have Christian theologians who have been very much involved and whose own thinking has been shaped by this dialogue. Okay, now I want to sort of briefly summarize what Garrodi has to say about Christian Marxist dialogue, because that will give you sort of the one Marxist side of this, and you can see some of the kind of thinking that's being done. Garrity is a French communist. He's rather, I think he's one of the chief ideologists of the French Communist Party and was, for a time, the party secretary. So he's not just, you know, out of it in terms of the party organization. But French communism in general is pretty independent over against the Moscow magisterium, so to speak. And that's true, I think, of the European communist parties in general, is that they have become fairly nationalistic, fairly independent, and more and more willing to be critical of the Rome of Moscow. Okay, briefly, Garrity starts out this way, by trying to define the traditional objections, not traditional, but the objections that of Marxism and Christianity to each other that emerged in recent dialogue. He starts out by saying that the Marxist objection to Christianity was not a rejection of authentic Christianity, which he sees as the apocalyptic Christianity, but rather it was a rejection of Constantinian Christianity. Constantinian Christianity had domesticated the church in an established relationship to the ruling classes, and it had also assimilated a Greco-Latin ideology and thereby created a hierarchical concept of the world, a hierarchical concept of the world which made the world a kind of fixed, unchanging thing that had no revolutionary principle. So it was this Constantinian Christianity, established in an established relationship to ruling classes and absorbing a hierarchical, static concept of the world, this is the Christianity which Marxism rejects. This kind of Constantinian church must necessarily resist change because of its social identification with the ruling established power structure and its metaphysical identification of the norms of human existence with a fixed hierarchical concept of being. However, in contrast to this Hellenistic Constantinian Christianity, there is a second Christianity, which is the tradition of apocalyptic Christianity. This is the authentic foundation of the gospel. It's nice to have a Marxist telling you what the authentic foundation of the gospel is. This is the authentic foundation of the gospel. And this tradition has flowed in a suppressed protest stream within Christianity down to the present. With this tradition, Marxism can not only sympathize, but can claim it as a part of its own heritage. However, Garrity then goes on to say, the new situation in Christianity is one in which Constantinian Christianity has to a large extent been dethroned. In other words, Constantinian Christianity is already dying. It has been unseated from power. It has been theologically discredited by Christian theologians. And therefore, to a large extent, the revolutionary Christianity is the Christianity which is becoming more and more the basis for recent Christian theology. Garrity then talks about various theologians whom he happens to like. He likes Bultmann, his program of existential demythologizing of the gospel, because he feels this is a concept of the gospel which opens the gospel up to continual experimentalism. He likes Teilhard de Chardin because he sees Teilhard's vision of the gospel as a kind of revolutionary progress going on and on to continue, you know, a orientation of the gospel to man's future hope. He also speaks of Teilhard, I think a very nice expression. He says that Teilhard's concept of the gospel is an evidence of the conversion of the church to the hopes of the earth. See, I mean, he thinks that the traditional Christianity was kind of pie in the sky by and by, telling people to be content with their lot here and now because they would be rewarded in heaven. And therefore, it was alienated from man's hopes of the earth, whereas in Teilhard and in the New Christianity, you have a conversion of the church to the hopes of the earth. He then says that here in this New Christianity, you can find a synthesis of the Christian God of the above with the Marxist God of the ahead. And that's a kind of interesting phrase because he uses the word God here. The synthesis of the Christian God of the above with the Marxist God of the future, or the God of the ahead. And it's in this kind of New Christianity that Marxism can speak in authentic dialogue. They can speak in authentic dialogue with this kind of Christianity because it has rejected Constantinianism, it has rejected the relationship with the established classes, it has also rejected this Greek concept of static hierarchical being, and has come to view human life as a continual movement forward in free decisions and new possibilities. It says, only with this kind of view of man can true history become possible. In other words, the static view of man does not allow true history to be possible. Only in this open-ended view of man as continually creating his life does true history become possible. There is in the New Christianity a recovery of the apocalypticism of primitive Christianity as the religion of protest against the established order and the hope for a coming kingdom. And this is the kind of change within Christianity that makes possible a Christian-Marxist dialogue from the Marxist point of view. He then goes on to say that this kind of dialogue is not merely a luxury for a few intellectuals, but it is a necessity for ongoing human survival. Only when we achieve a common understanding and united front of Christians and Marxists can we prevent the annihilation of the human race. Whereas this continual misunderstanding, rivalry, and antagonism between Christians and Marxists poses a threat to human existence itself. Whereas, if Marxists and Christians could get together, they could remake the face of the earth. So that's his sort of basis, where he thinks that a historical situation has come about where Christians and Marxists can talk to each other. He then goes on to deal with some questions which were posed to him by Karl Rahner and Johann Metz at this dialogue in Salzburg in 1965. Karl Rahner, apparently Garaudy had defined Marxist humanism as a methodology of historical initiative for the realization of the total man. And Karl Rahner had replied to this by challenging the Marxists to recognize the necessity of God for an integral humanism. In other words, if you are a humanist, then you ought to recognize that you cannot have a full humanism without God. Rahner then defined Christianity as the religion of the absolute future, which is a kind of interesting way of defining Christianity for a Jesuit. Christianity is the religion of the absolute future, and this religion of the absolute future does not sacralize the present. In other words, it doesn't make the present into a kind of a holy, sacred, untouchable thing, but rather it teaches us to understand everything on the basis of what is in process of arrival. In other words, he's posing Christianity as a religion of progress here. But this view of a continually self-transcending history is only possible if the historical progress itself is not self-enclosed and self-grounded. In other words, you can believe that history is continually moving forward if you believe that history is not self-enclosed, but rather that history is grounded in an absolute transcendent existence which is beyond history. In other words, history can be open-ended because there is an absolute transcendence beyond it, which is God. So this whole idea of a transcendence within history is only possible if there is an absolute transcendence beyond history, namely God. Only by making this essential distinction between every human project and the absolute future is it possible to affirm the real value of every achievement and therefore avoid sort of sacralizing the revolution, is what he's talking about here. Now, this kind of critique from Rahner, I think, is pretty much the basic critique you get from most of these Christians of Marxism. It's the same critique that Frau Magda makes. It's the same critique that Niebuhr made, and so on. That you have to have an absolute transcendence beyond history as the ground for this inner transcendence within history. Only then can you really affirm the partial but real value of every achievement, and as Rahner says, avoid the temptation of brutally sacrificing each generation in favor of the next succeeding generation, and therefore making the future into a Moloch to which the real man is sacrificed in favor of the man who is not real but is still to come. In other words, you are sacrificing the present generation to the future, unless you have a sense of an absolute transcendence beyond history. In a similar way, Johann Metz also question Marxists about this, asking them whether the dialectic of the future of man does not give birth itself to the question of the future of God. In other words, again, an absolute transcendence beyond history that grounds and makes possible a relative transcendence within history. Okay, so this is the sort of question posed to him by these fine Catholic theologians, to which Garrity now wishes to reply. Garrity replies to these questions first by defining the Marxist historical dialectic. He says that the historical dialectic is not materialism in the philosophical sense, but rather it is an empirical existential method. Marxist methodology wishes to reject all purely theoretical answers and instead to create models which will direct man to a grappling with his concrete historical conditions. Marxism believes that existence precedes essence. In other words, the ideas become real only through historical practice. He says that early religion, the religion of myth and symbol and so forth, were really sort of primitive forms of science and technology, whereby the imagination was led into a forward-moving practice through analogy and symbol. And these theories are not absolute. Theories are not absolute. Ideas are not absolute. But rather, ideas and theories are simply models to be tested in historical practice. And they arise out of historical practice. And he says that Marxism today needs a plurality of models to meet the historical needs of revolutionaries in many kinds of non-Western countries who have very different circumstances and backgrounds from that of the European experience in which socialism originated. In other words, he's opting here for a kind of pluralistic, nationalistic socialism, which is also something that differentiates the Marxist humanists from party, Russian party communism. Okay, that's sort of his initiating thing, you know. He says, we're not materialists, we're experimentalists, is what he's saying. And we believe in pluralism and so on. Okay. But then he goes on to try to show the deeper meaning of all this. He says that communist future hope is not merely a revolution in environment and social institutions, but rather it points ultimately to an inward transformation of man. And that's what I suggested was also in those early writings of Marx, that if you really took that seriously, it would suppose a kind of inward transformation of man, which would be the basis for the creation of the new society. And Garrity then goes on in very effulgent terms to characterize this new society as the one where love would cease to be a mere promise and moral law and become the objective law of the entire society, which is fantastic kind of statement. He just states it very boldly. In the new society, love will be the base, the objective law of the entire society. And it's a quotation from Garrity. If we are communists, it is precisely because we are struggling for this classless society. And he obviously does not equate that with Russian communism. We are struggling for the classless society. Our task as communists is to draw near to man in his most glorious dreams and his most sublime hopes, to draw near to him in a real and practical way so that Christians themselves might find here on earth the beginning of their heaven. He then says that communist society is not the end of history, but rather it is the authentic beginning of history for the first time. In the communist society, alienated man will be overcome, and the authentic man will make his first appearance on earth. But this authentic man will not be a kind of static achievement, but rather he will be the basis for a continual struggle forward. A continual struggle for the conquest of nature and the perfection of man's community together. Therefore, this transcendence within history is not a limitation, because this transcendence within history is itself infinite. See, he's getting together this inward transcendence with a concept of the infinite. So this transcendence within history is not a limitation, but because this transcendence within history is itself infinite, in other words, it goes on and on. There's no limit to it. Therefore, history itself contains its own dialectic of the finite and the infinite, and therefore it does not need to look beyond history to some, you know, infinite being above history as the ground of its infinite future hope. Once the alienated and hostile prehistoric man is overcome, that's us, you see, once this alienated and prehistoric man is overcome, then the truly historical man can flower in a never-ending aspiration toward infinite perfection. This is very sort of 19th century future hope, too. The endless dialectic of freedom made one with creation will flower. That's a quotation.
Rosemary, I wonder if
you okay.
Using the term transcendence, I wonder if this makes a this carrying meaning, conveying any meaning. And the problem there that Rahner poses regarding is indeed a very vital and crucial one. And I wonder if it might not be profitable for you to stop with and play with that some so that you see what the.
Yeah, right. That's really what practically all the main thing that he's saying. Let me just give this next section, which I think he goes into that, and then we can throw it around and see whether it's meant anything. Because he goes on to talk about how where he sort of breaks with the Christian concept of God. The problem that communists have with the Christian dialectic of the infinite and the finite is that the Christian concept of God sort of makes into a dogmatic answer something which communists see only as a question which is addressed to man in his historical situation. The Marxist lives under the same historical drive, the same historical need, so to speak, and the same tension between the finite present and the infinite hope as the Christian. In other words, the Christian and the communist both live in that same tension between the finite present and the infinite aspiration of man. But the communist does not confuse something which is only a question with an answer. He does not confuse a exigency with an existent being. That's sort of his basic differentiation. He does not confuse an exigency with an already existing being. God, he would agree with Rahner and these people, defining God as the absolute future of man, which is also the way Moltmann defines God. God is the absolute future of man. But to say that God is the absolute future of man does not establish God as an already existing being, which grounds and necessitates the success of man's project. But rather, God, when you define God in this way, you're simply saying that God is the ultimate aspiration of man. He is the not yet fulfilled being of man, which does not mean that he already exists as a being, but rather he is a non-existent hope. Transcendence, then, is man's forward aspiration, man's continual transcendence of himself to new possibilities. That is what transcendence is. Transcendence is man's self-transcendence and not God's presence and summons of man. The absolute future is nothing else except this endlessly expanding horizon of man's future aspirations. The future of man then is open on the infinite, and this is the only transcendence which is known to the Marxist. And then here's a quotation. We reject the name of God because it purports to claim that the answer to our need already exists, whereas, in fact, it is only an exigency which we live. A never satisfied exigency of totality and absoluteness, omnipotence, and perfect loving reciprocity of consciousness. We live this exigency, but we cannot hypostasize it. That means make it into a thing under the name of transcendence. Regarding this totality, you know, this final aspiration of man, this infinite, I can say everything about it except it is. For what it is always something deferred and always something growing, like man himself. If we wish to give it a name, that name will not be that of God, for it is impossible to conceive of a God who is always in process. And that of course, might be questioned. Maybe it is possible to conceive of a God who's also always in process. Maybe Whitehead could tell us something about that. But Garrity assumes it's impossible to conceive of a God who is always in process, who is always in process of being born. The most beautiful and most exalted name which can be given to this exigency is the name of man. To refuse to give man this name is to strip him of one of his dimensions, in fact, his essential specific dimension, for man is he who is not. That's how he defines man. Man is he who is not yet, perhaps. Man is he who is not yet, who has not yet arrived. This exigency in man, I think, is the flesh of your God. That's what he says to the Christians. This exigency in man, this need, this self-transcending need, aspiration to the infinite, this is, I think, the flesh of your God. We cannot say that God, as the symbol of the absolute future of man, already exists, and we already move within him, because the project of the future is not predetermined. In other words, we can't say that God already exists and we already have the ground of this self-transcendence of man, because this whole project isn't predetermined. We don't know whether it'll succeed or not. It's really open. It's an open possibility, which has no assurance. The making of the future of man is a project that's carried out in real uncertainty and risk, without any a priori divine being that assures its success. So whereas the Christian sees transcendence as an existing being and the guarantee of the future hope, Marxists can only define it as an exigency and an absence, a demand within man, but a demand for which there is no guarantee of success. There's another little section here, but I think we could sort of stop
Would
there.
Would you define the word exigency?
Exigency, well, need, inner demand for continual betterment, all of that.
Could you come up with some examples now of where the poo-poo hits the fan on this and this idea? What difference does it make? Getting away from these words, technical terms. What kind of thing, for example, would Rotter point to in the history of socialism or communism to say, see, this is what happens if...
Yeah, well, what Rotter has said and what Romagda and Niebuhr and all these people have said is that unless you have an absolute future, you end up deifying the results of a particular revolution. You see, you have to sort of identify the infinite with a particular project of achievement, because that becomes your infinite. You have an imminent kind of idea of man's aspiration, which can then be identified with the results of a particular revolution, and that's precisely where you get a kind of idolatrous institutionalism of communism. You see, and that, so that they would see the lack of a sense of a truly transcendent God as really the basis for the development of Marxism into a static, rigid, ideological kind of thing.
Without God, man is capable. The revolutionary, the Marxist, the communist is capable of thinking that he's infallible.
Yeah, you get an infallible. You know,
you get Stalinism.
Yeah, you get Stalinism. Unless you have a concept of a transcendence which is continually beyond you. Now, Garrity is really trying to counter that objection by saying that Marxism never stops. You see, that its concept of the infinite can never be just associated or identified with a particular revolutionary achievement, because this elan is infinite; it's continually transcending itself. So he's trying to really respond to that by getting a concept of an infinite transcendence, but within history, moving continually onward. So in his own way, he's also trying to counter Stalinism. With a new concept of the infinite, which can be a critical principle over against Stalinism, but without opting for the Christian formula. And I think the reason why he can't opt for the Christian formula is really because his concept of God as an existing being is really defined for him as a primordial being. So he sees this as soon as you believe this, you've got a kind of a static idea, where all the possibilities are already defined by an existing being. You see. And Moltmann it might be sort of questionable whether Moltmann has really answered this, but Moltmann, of course, practically takes over whole hog. His idea of God as the absolute future of man and tries to show it as the real Christian idea. But the funny thing that happens in Moltmann is that you really sort of lose any God of the beginning or any concept. The symbols of creation and God of the beginning sort of disappear.
Okay.
Yeah?
About 3 years ago, just before this book came out, in reality there was an interview between Garrity and the guy that all his interviews, controversial people in Paris. And one of the questions that Garrity posed to this man was, why don't you Christians ever give us any kind of understanding of debt. He said, this is not, debt is a real problem in our particular, you know, approach, because we have no kind of, you know, way to face it. And he said, he thought that this was a problem that he thought should be met in this coming dialogue. This was before.
Yeah. Well, Garrity, toward the end of this book, goes on to talk about what he thinks Christians can learn from Marxists and what he thinks Marxists can learn from Christians. What he thinks Christians can learn from Marxists is what he calls the conversion of the church to the hopes of the earth. You see, that the Christians will really plug into the needs of man. That's what they can learn from Marxists. But on the other hand, what he thinks Marxists can learn from Christians are terribly theological kind of ideas. What he wants to learn from Christians is more about subjectivity and more about transcendence. You see, now these are the two ideas that he feels in Marxism have not a deep enough understanding. They need to understand a deeper sense of man's soul, really, subjectivity, and a deeper sense of transcendence. And that's what all these Marxists came rushing to talk about, transcendence with Christians. And of course, Christians, you know, Harvey Cox and all that, they just want to talk about revolution. They want to talk about transcendence and subjectivity. Yeah, well, I think he talks about these two things, subjectivity and transcendence, and I think that his interest in talking about death would be included in that idea.
Yeah, I know, what I meant was in terms of a dialogue, in an interview, in communication, I mean, transcendence, you know, well, that was sort of part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is that what made it concrete was the word death.
Yeah.
He brought that up, you know, then you feel, you know, the bristling.
Yeah, that Marxists hadn't had a deep enough understanding of the inwardness of man and so on. That was the second sort of thing that he wanted to talk about.
He made a point that I thought was interesting. I'd like to know your reaction.
He
said, in other words, God is too limited. You were talking about Gaudí's conception of God. And he said, in other words,
idea that there is no growth in
Yeah, I think Garrity's concept of believing in God is kind of limited to that classical concept of a being, you know, in the metaphysical. And
there's another relationship here, question that comes to me, and this is in regard to the leftist Christians. Here, in a sense, I seem to feel a relationship with Garrity and the perfectionism of some of the fundamentalists.
I don't know, maybe not so much the perfectionism of fundamentalism, but what Marxism comes out of is very much, of course, 19th century progressivism. I mean, this feeling of infinite possibilities, you see, which was so much the faith of the 19th century. And of course, crisis theology with Bart and so forth sort of rejected that for an idea of the limited man, and, you know, sort of bowing down before this infinite God who is constantly breaking down his idolatries and so forth. That was the neo-Orthodox idea, and that was also a basis on which people like Fromagde and Niebuhr criticized Marxism. But on the other hand, beyond that, you have people like Moltmann and Cox and so forth who are sort of post neo-Orthodox, who sort of assimilated neo-Orthodoxy, but who also want to get back to some of that optimism, you see, that some of that optimism of the 19th century, because they feel that somehow in the midst of all this insistence on the limitations of man, we've pretty much developed a kind of so that's the way it is kind of philosophy,
fatalism.
You see, kind of fatalism, that realism sort of drifts gradually to the right toward fatalism and toward a kind of pessimistic thing, and so I think another reason for sort of trying from the Christian side of wanting to plug into Marxism is to plug back into that kind of faith of man's faith in man's potential, faith in man's possibilities. And I think that's why there's a kind of fascination with Teilhard. I mean, Teilhard's kind of the last of the 19th century men in many ways.
And sort of the idea is you've got too small. This is sort of approach. That opens possibilities with a greater God.
Yeah, the God who is sort of not limited to sort of blessing this particular social system, which is kind of the medieval hierarchical conception.
In a way, I mean, it kind of makes a comment. The problem is not that Garrity's God is too limited, but that he is too unlimited, in a way. By that I mean, he takes over the classical conception of God, which when it worked, when you work it all out, what it means is that from eternity, it was all there. And everything that's happening is just sort of, you know, the inevitable bringing out, spelling out of what was in the mind of God. Because if anything really new occurred in creation, it would mean that God was changing. And we all know that for God to change is, you know, that's impossible, because that subtracts from his deity. Well, this is a prejudice that we picked up from the
Greeks. This is classical logos theology, is that God had the master plan.
Yeah.
Logos is the great master plan, you see.
But we make it all static. We make theology static and God static and the world static, in a sense, by trying to pay compliments to God. And if we got away from this and got back to a biblical theology, we might discover that God is much more limited, in a sense, than we've tried to make him to be. And because he is limited, he is more human, more related to the universe, and more capable of doing the kinds of things which the apocalyptic Christians and the Marxists, and I think the New Testament too, insist he's doing.
Yeah, well, the whole idea of suffering God is something which Christians have always sort of shied away from, the implications of, you know. I mean, let's not say that God himself really descended on that cross.
See, we can't believe. We say it with one heart, one part of our heads, that God really cares what we're doing down here, that it makes a difference what we're doing. But then when we get into our philosophical bag and really get straight on what we mean, it doesn't make any difference, because it's all predetermined anyway. And
yeah,
how could it affect God? But the Bible really asserts that it does make a difference to God. And if we don't retain that emphasis, I think we do drift into a kind of fatalism.
Yeah, I think that for Garrity and also for Moltmann, the God of the beginning and also the idea of creation get sort of dissolved, because they are still identifying this with classical logos theology, where you had the great master plan at the beginning and nothing, you know, the whole thing was sort of predetermined. Whereas they're stretching for a continual, you know, creation as an ongoing project. You know, that God is still creating, and therefore God himself is still moving. And of course, this is very Hegelian too. I mean, a lot of this whole thing in Marx does also go back to Hegel with the.
I find myself getting a little nervous, because I sense that Paul is challenging the basic doctrine very much of the Presbyterian. Are you suggesting that there's something wrong with predestination?
You can answer that one, Bob.
You don't really want me to answer that.
Is dialogue perceptibly growing?
Well, I'd say the dialogue, in terms of what it actually produced, it was a kind of nice armchair discussion between Eastern European intellectuals, alienated from a party structure and so on, and these sort of, Western European theologians. I remember reading a sort of description of this great meeting in Salzburg, and the cars drove up, and out of one limousine got four Catholic priests all dressed in black suits. And then these big, heavy car drove up, and out of that got the Protestant theologians with their fat German wives. You know, you could see this big establishment gathering. You know, it's really great. The communists, I guess, were already there. I don't know. The Christians were all driving to Prague, is what this was.
Isn't a part of the failure of the dialogue to produce anything the fact that to a degree the ones who are participating in the dialogue are the discredited ones?
Well, they're not so much discredited, because Garrity isn't discredited and so on. I would say that it doesn't produce anything, because it's going on in non-revolutionary societies to a large extent. Czechoslovakia and so on, these countries have a kind of struggle, to be sure, and so it could have important implications there. But at this point, they're very limited, because none of these countries are really able to move very much.
It doesn't involve the ones who are really struggling.
And Cox has a little article in Dialogue, which is I think a Lutheran journal. It's pretty good. He had an article in there called I got it someplace of something Yeah, Christian Marxist dialogue. And there he ends up by saying, you know, that the really important thing will be where this dialogue really kind of gets together with real practice of social change. And there, of course, you know, he looks to South America with all those Catholic nuns and priests running up to join the guerrillas. There are not really that many of them anyway. There's sort of this hopeful idea that somehow in Latin America you might get some kind of real cooperation, for which there is, I think, some possibility, but it's still pretty small.
There's a real danger that the Marxists with whom Christians will establish dialogue will be condemned as revisionists by the majority.
Oh, they're all revisionists. I mean, I would say the very whole basis.
But I mean, they will be condemned by the Marxists that are really making a difference. Another, Garrodia is concerned to avoid the destruction of the world by Marxism versus Christianity. But the trouble is the Marxism with which Christianity is getting in dialogue is strong in countries that are probably moving toward the United States anyway.
Yeah.
He's still assuming that it's Russia versus the United States kind of.
Yeah, well, I'd say that the whole Marxist humanism would be revisionism over against, you know, traditional Leninism.
Does the dialogue imply that what seemed to me the basic differences between the Marxist humanist and the Christian theology are reconcilable? Or is it a basis that they can coexist?
Well, I think it's a basis that they have an awful lot in common, even though they might not be able to get their theories finally together, that they have a great deal in common, that the Christian affirmation of God and the basic Marxist affirmation of the future really rest on fundamentally the same human experience defined in different ways and so on. I think that's what he's saying. And they also have a common human concern.
Yes.
So I think he's saying that we have enough in common that we can do a lot together.
It seems to me that the commonness is between Christian humanist and the Marxist humanist.
Well, I can't imagine how you could be a Christian if you hated man.
No, but how can you be communist and accept the personal God of Christianity?
Well, he's
saying that Christianity is
no. He's saying we can't accept the personal God of Christianity and because of how we understand what God means. He understands God as being a static concept, but we can affirm all the values from which faith in God has produced. I'll read you this last little section, which is kind of nice. What matters is that human faith not mutilate any of the dimensions of man which have come about and been won through faith in God, and faith in the transcendent God not mutilate the faith in the human task. These are the mutual fruits which each can hope to win through dialogue between Christian humanism and Marxist Promethean humanism. If each of us can take stock of what is best in his conviction, what is basic in his convictions, he will discover the one in his faith in God. He doesn't want Christians to give up their faith in God. The one in his faith in God, the other in his faith in his task as a man, a mutual willingness to stretch man's creative energies to the maximum for the sake of the realizing of the total man. Which is, kind of exciting.
You said something at the beginning I wondered about. You said that communism, Marxism, communism, Christianity might develop, if they don't get into dialogue, into a conflict which will destroy the world, which will be terrible or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you've got a fortress of missiles and counter-missiles and you're all developing...
I thought our Christian hope was that the end of the world would come.
There are ends of the world and ends of the world. That's not the end I want, baby.
One thing, Rosemary, that you're going to start to go along with, too, is this whole lack of knowledge in the 19th century in our American tradition here, aren't you? I mean, the European church meets communism much more realistically than we do because they know Feuerbach, they know Marx's relation with Feuerbach, they know that he became an atheist before he became a communist. All these things are very clear to our European church, and so the dialogue is very easy.
Well,
anti-communist bias like we do.
Yeah.
I mean, they realize that this is another form, like Rumunka is there, the Czech theologians who are Christians who've been operating in a very dialogue situation. Oh, this is a vital part of their mental equipment, and it isn't of ours. And I think that's where we live in conversation.
We have so much
We don't know the 19th century took place. We really don't. And actually, Marx is a child of Pietism in a very real way. I mean, he had a distorted kind of Christianity to which he was exposed and confronted again. In the Lutheran Compromise, don't forget, came out of this kind of individualistic, subjective Pietism that only knew the individual and the personal savior. there's no corporate relationship with God or a covenant relationship.
Yeah. And when Feuerbach and Marx attack Christianity, they're attacking Hegel. That's what they think Christianity is.
Exactly. They're putting him on his feet like that.